Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for, I think of it as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. That war is being waged at this moment, as we speak, in the Senate of the United States, which is to consider very shortly a piece of legislation that was passed last night by the House of Representatives. A very troubling piece of legislation, the latest in several, actually, troubling pieces of legislation that have been taken up with the active assent and, well, permission, for that matter, of the House Republican leadership. Republicans not yet in control in the Senate, of course, but none of this would have been happening without John Boehner's active support. To discuss this with us is, I think, one of the most astute observers of these kinds of activities on Capitol Hill and elsewhere in our government. He is a senior editor for the very highly regarded new publication, conservativereview.com. He is Daniel Horowitz, and we're hearing just a little bit of background music coming from the new nursery. Congratulations, Daniel, on your new offspring as well as the new publication. Great to have you with us.
Great to be here.
Daniel, I think by any measure, the message that should have come, should have been received loud and clear from this leadership, establishment leadership, you call it, was that the voters actually did not want more of the Barack Obama agenda. And yet it seems on so many counts, including notably, and I want to turn to this, the amnesty that the president has just declared by executive fiat, that wasn't what they had in mind in this last election, was it?
It's literally as if the elections never took place. Here in my state of Maryland, there was a lot of discussion during early voting about Republican ballots being rendered automatically Democrat ballots by faulty voting machines. It's almost as if this had happened on a national scale. We all went out and voted Republican, and out pops Democrat policies. The sight of John Boehner, the House Republican Speaker, and President Obama together whipping votes for this budget bill is just unreal. I mean, it's as if the voters didn't matter. And the amazing thing is, and this is really the central point of this budget bill, it gives Barack Obama the authority and the funding for everything he wants to do until the rest of the fiscal year, which is through next October. So particularly with a president like this, who has shown himself to be, you know, just to have an utter disregard for the Constitution and his alacrity to work without Congress, not just on immigration, I mean, that's certainly the most egregious aspect, but many, many other spheres, the last thing you want to do is cede the power of the purse for the rest of the year, and that is exactly what Congress did last night.
And why would you say they did it? Is it that they have the majority of them at least, have such an affinity for these policies that have been repudiated at the polls, in your estimation, Daniel Horowitz, or is there something else going on?
There's an uncomfortable truth that many Republicans and conservatives need to confront. This is not a disagreement over strategy or tactics or even the notion that the Republicans are, quote-unquote, the stupid party or inept, spineless. It's a disagreement over values. John Boehner, Mitch McConnell, the GOP leadership in Washington, they fundamentally do not share our values. They are not outraged by Obama's power grab. They are not outraged by his open borders policies because they support it. And whereas we view the power of the purse as the consummate tool to combat this president, they view it as the plague to be avoided. They want to avoid confrontation at all costs. So to them, slipping through a budget bill right before the Christmas break within 48 hours that will put everything on autopilot, give Obama all the funding he needs, and get that point of contention out of the way, that is a win in a sadly perverse way for these leaders.
They will say in their own defense that, no, but you're misstating what they did. They withheld the full year funding from the Department of Homeland Security as a break on this executive fiat, this overreach, as they like to call it, by the president on amnesty. Is that not the case, Daniel?
Sure. So what they did in order to have a talking point is they funded 11 departments through next October, but severed out DHS and only funded that through February. But they don't complete the sentence. Okay, well, what will you do with that in February? Have they made a promise to defund amnesty then? Of course not. They actually want to buy time to pass legislative amnesty. They support this. They will not defund it. And there's a couple other points here that are important to point out. Immigration funding is not just in the Department of Homeland Security. The Office of Refugee Resettlement, which is housed within Health and Human Services, that is very instrumental and has been instrumental in establishing routes for illegal aliens. All the 60,000 illegal minors that came in from Central America, they've dispersed billions of dollars already. The Department of Education has done it through the education system, the Justice Department, State Department. So you need to defund amnesty throughout all spheres of government. Not only did this bill not defund and put all those agencies full funded on autopilot through next October, this bill actually threw in several billion more in additional immigration funding that will now be used to facilitate Obama's amnesty.
I couldn't agree with you more. This is the Rubicon. I believe it is the end of the Republican Party if this is in fact permitted to go the distance, and it seems as though the go code is now in place for it to do that. But I'm thinking of other things that the Congress at least ostensibly is concerned about and you'd think would want to be able to block or at least have the leverage to modify through the only real tool available to them, namely the power of the purse. And I'm thinking of things like the president's decision through, again, executive fiat to empty Guantanamo Bay, or the president's actions through the EPA to wage war on coal, or the president's actions to conduct the campaign against the Islamic State, however he wishes to, or the Obamacare debacle, or more immigration initiatives. I mean, it really just strains credulity that even where the direct self-interest of these Republican leaders, you'd think, to have a party, for example, to remain majorities, are being dispensed with altogether.
I wrote an open letter stressing this exact point to GOP leaders, and this is the point I made. I said, look, we all understand that you guys couldn't give a rip about immigration. You downright support Obama on the issue, so it's unlikely you'll ever vigorously oppose him, even though he's done it illegally, he's done it, made an run around Congress. But there's got to be some issue you care about. Mitch McConnell is from the state of Kentucky. He has thousands of people in eastern Kentucky out of work because of Obama's war on coal and his executive, unilateral regulations through the EPA that shut down the power plants there. So what are you going to do about that?
Well, and the irony of this is that was one of the things the last time I checked, he was running for re-election. He was going to do something about it. For that matter, I think he was also campaigning. He was going to do something to stop this amnesty business, too. This is really a betrayal of the public trust of the First Order. Do you think there will be any consequences for these leaders when people who also campaigned against these kinds of things turn up in the next Congress?
Well, look, there's only one leverage point left against these leaders, and particularly John Boehner. On January 7th, there will be an election on the House floor for Speaker of the House, and Democrats will nominate Nancy Pelosi, but they don't. Obviously, they lack the votes to get her elected. They're in the minority. Republicans will nominate John Boehner. But he needs 218 votes, not just more votes than Pelosi. He needs an outright majority of those present in the chamber voting in order to win that election. There's 246 Republicans. The magic number here is 29. If 29 Republicans that call themselves conservatives, and look, you saw last night, 67 House Republicans voted against this bill. If they're really that outraged by it, where is the plan to take down Speaker Boehner?
You will be following it closely. Daniel Horowitz at theconservativereview.com, an absolutely indispensable new resource. Thank you for that. Keep it up. We'll talk with you soon. Next up, we will be speaking with Captain Bill Harlow, one of the contributors to CIASavedLives.com, the response to the so-called torture report. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
If you listen to this radio station a lot, you may have noticed our brand new name. It's got a catchy ring to it. But there's more than that. The name actually tells you who we are and what we do in one word. It took us a while to come up with this, but we realized if there's one thing we want to be to DC listeners, it was this. We want to be your answer to everything, to what happened while you slept, to why am I stuck in traffic, to how do you get control of this country again. Big stuff and little stuff. This may be a tall order for one radio station, but we know we're up for it. AM 1260, The Answer.
Great news for fans of Secure Freedom Radio. Now you can watch original Frank Gaffney and Center for Security Policy video content every day from the comfort of your living room. What makes this possible? A new video streaming service called Roku. All you need is a Roku player and a television to join the millions of Americans who customize their home viewing experience using the more than 1,000 Roku channels to access movies, TV shows, music, and more. When you add the cost-free Secure Freedom Roku channel, you'll gain unlimited streaming access to vital video products of the center, including Secure Freedom Radio, Capitol Hill and National Press Club events, intelligence briefings, Frank Gaffney's acclaimed 10-part Muslim Brotherhood in America course, and more. The Secure Freedom Roku channel integrates information and entertainment, establishing a new media battle space in the war for the free world. Go to securefreedom.org/ROKU today to learn how you can be a part of it. We hope you'll see us soon.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back. I'm very pleased to say joined by a retired Navy captain by the name of Bill Harlow, who has served in senior positions in previous administrations with great distinction in uniform, notably as an assistant White House press secretary for foreign affairs and national security during both the Reagan administration, brings such a warm feeling to my heart, Captain, and to that of George H.W. Bush. He is currently involved in a very important project, kind of a spinoff, if you will, of some work that he did with George Tenet in connection with their number one bestseller, At the Center of the Storm, namely providing kind of a truth squad on what the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence has just done with its report, now universally known as the, quote, torture report, unquote. Captain Harlow, welcome to Secure Freedom Radio, sir, and thank you for your service both in uniform in the past and that you're rendering these days with a terrific website you call CIA Saved Lives. Very glad to have you with us, sir.
Good to be with you.
Would you kind of just sort of set the table for us by giving us your sort of overall perspective on this report by the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence majority, I hasten to say, just the majority?
Sure. They've been working on this report for 5.5 years and just put it out this week, and a number of people that I know who have looked at it have told me that it's probably the single worst piece of analysis ever put out by a government agency. Now, that's going some.
And that is saying something.
But it's certainly a badly flawed report, and it does damage to the truth, it does damage to our national security, and unfortunately it's being swallowed hook, line, and sinker by a lot of people in the media and some members of the public who only see the headlines and believe it. So we've been trying to do a little truth squatting to the best we can.
Well, I think quite commendably, including your former boss and colleague George Tenet and others who ran the Central Intelligence Agency for a number of years, who have really come up on the net hard on this. We're visiting with Captain Bill Harlow, United States Navy retired, a man who has, as I said earlier, contributed mightily, both in uniform and since taking it off. One of his other books is entitled Hard Measures, How Aggressive CIA Actions After 9/11 Saved American Lives, something that very much informed the website that he is helping to host called CIA saved lives. And Captain, talk if you would about how wrong this report is with respect to some of the findings, notably the contention that the enhanced interrogation techniques did not save lives, in fact, did not contribute materially to our understanding of enemy operations at all.
Yeah, that's one of the amazing things. A number of those of us who worked at the CIA back at the time this program was going on, we were very much aware that this program, if it became publicly known, would be controversial because it certainly was a harsh interrogation program. But no one ever thought that it would be accused of being ineffective, because we saw the intelligence pouring in day after day after terrorists like Abu Zubaydah and Khalid Sheikh Mohammed became compliant. They provided enormous amounts of intelligence, which was absolutely verified and really did help save lives, help disrupt plots, helped us understand the organization of Al-Qaeda, understand its operating territories, helped point towards individuals, and it provided tremendous support. For some reason, the people in the Senate Intelligence Committee who decided to do this investigation chose not to argue what reasonably could be argued about, do you want your government to do this kind of thing? Instead, they tried to discredit it by saying it didn't produce any results. And that's just absurd. What bothers us, one of the many things that bothers us, is that all of the reporting seems to be about the allegations in the Feinstein report, and yet no one is talking about the other report that was submitted by the Senate current minority, which points out all of the errors in the Feinstein report and clearly shows that the program was effective. Nor do they talk about the document put out by the CIA, the current CIA, which again points out numerous errors in this report. About 18 of the 20 cases that the Feinstein report cites, the CIA, the current CIA, debunks. And understand that they are working for the Obama administration, and yet they've had the courage to point out that Feinstein's people got it wrong. So it's been a interesting and a bit frustrating experience for us.
I can only imagine. And one of the things that jumps out at, I think, anybody who bothers to look into this story at all is it had to have contributed to the factual errors in the majority report that they didn't actually talk to any of the people involved in this program. I mean, it almost boggles the mind that you could go for 5 years, you could spend $40 million taxpayer dollars and not have done that most basic of, you know, investigative techniques.
It's truly amazing that they would do that. And even their excuse that they give about why they didn't talk to someone is laughable and absurd. When pressed on that now, they say, well, we didn't have to talk to anyone, or we couldn't talk to them because there were ongoing DOJ investigations. Well, there were some ongoing investigations, the last of which ended in 2012.
Some time ago. Yeah.
And even then, the people who were under investigation, it's only a handful of people. They could have easily asked to speak with the CIA directors, and there were three of them involved during this period of time, or the deputy directors, or the head of the clandestine service, or a number of other people who were not under investigation, the head of the general counsel of the agency. And even the people who were under investigation, they weren't prohibited from talking to them. They just, the agency leadership said, we couldn't force you to talk if you didn't want to. But they didn't bother to ask because they didn't want to hear.
That's the point.
Might hear from people who actually knew what was going on.
And would contradict their working hypothesis and the one that
exactly.
They have now promoted. Let me just go back to something that you said earlier. And again, our guest is Captain Bill Harlow, United States Navy retired. He is an author and public relations specialist, including among his works, Hard Measures, How Aggressive CIA Action After 9/11 Saved American Lives, co-authored with another great American, in my estimation, Jose Rodriguez. Captain, there has been much made of this idea of compliance. Some who profess to be experts in these matters say, you don't want somebody you're interrogating to be compliant. You know, you want them to be maintaining a degree of independence, and that way you're not just being fed whatever the individual thinks you want to hear from them. John McCain, among others, has, I think, been touting this on the basis of his own experience with torture. Address that very quickly, if you would.
Sure. Well, to start with, again, and we would contend mightily this was not torture, but the people who were subjected to interrogation, the enhanced interrogation techniques, that only lasted for a few days, a few weeks at most, and then for years after that, they provided valuable intelligence. We didn't accept it hook, line, and sinker. We would take the information that we got from Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, from Abu Zubaydah and others, and we would check it against other information. The vast majority of it proved to be true, that valuable information. Occasionally they would lie to us, but we could check it against other people. So we weren't naive about it, but to suggest that they were telling us only what we wanted to hear to stop the pain is ridiculous, because whatever pain they felt, it stopped months, years beforehand. And they provided valuable information, which is documented, and it's amazing to us how the Feinstein Committee can deny that.
You are documenting it handsomely. Check out the terrific monitoring and truth-telling that is being told by Captain Harlow and his colleagues at CIASavedLives.com. Captain, I hope you'll come back to us again soon, as there's so much more to talk with you about, and I'm afraid we're just hard out of time, but I appreciate you taking the time now, and again, thank you for what you have done for our country in the past and what you're doing right now. Next up, Tariq Fatah from Canada, a moderate Muslim, talks about Sharia, civilization, jihad, and the threat it poses to Western civilization. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. For decades, the OPEC cartel has artificially hiked up oil prices by manipulating supply. When demand would drop, OPEC nations would simply cut production, and members of the cartel got rich at our expense. At the moment, however, Saudi Arabia has decided that there's something more important than short-term profits. The Saudis are refusing to cut production, outraging OPEC members critically dependent upon inflated oil prices. The reason? Saudi royals are determined to drive new American oil producers out of business before they constitute too much of a threat to the cartel and its ability to set world prices. U.S. consumers are benefiting from reduced gas prices, and bad actors in Russia, Venezuela, and Iran are being badly hurt. But we can't allow the Saudis to strangle our prospects for energy security. This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. I am thrilled to say we are joined by a man I've come to know and admire greatly, based in Canada, but star of a film that was shown here in the United States a few years back that I had a small hand in pulling off. It was called Islam versus Islamists. He is Tariq Fatah. He is one of the weekly columnists for the Toronto Sun. He is the host of his own talk radio program on Toronto's News Talk 1010 network. He is calling it What the Fatah, which is pretty much the leitmotif of what I want to talk with you about, Tariq. What the Fatah is going on, well, really on both sides of the border with respect to people who share your faith but don't exactly practice it as you do in a very moderate, indeed secular way, I think it's fair to say, but who seek to impose Sharia upon both your country and ours, and indeed Western civilization more generally. Let me start by saying welcome back. It's good to have you with us as always, but feel free to fire for effect on that question, and particularly this fellow that you've profiled, Jamal Badawi.
Well, thank you for having me, but what Jamal Badawi, he's a professor, retired professor from one of our Atlantic provinces, but is fairly involved in Islamist organizations that are within the United States of America. And most of these Islamists are actually transcontinental. To be very clear, they don't even recognize, in effect, the border between Canada and United States. Most of the organizations are based in the United States and have branch operations in Canada, but they are quite vocal here in Canada about exactly what they want, which is a political system that they take inspiration from Islam and which they wish to impose. They don't even hide their intention, especially Professor Jamal Badawi, who has been on the board of many organizations that were described by or labeled by the U.S. Justice Department as unindicted co-conspirators in the Texas terror funding trial.
Well, let me just ask you, Tariq, what they refer to when they describe what they're seeking is, at least the more transparent of them, like Badawi, is the imposition of Sharia. And just tell us in a brief form, if you would, what that is, what it entails, and whether it is universally subscribed to, notably by Muslims in Canada and the United States as well.
I would suggest that most religious Muslims, practicing Muslims, have come to agree. Most of them don't participate in it, but there is a general consensus that the ultimate goal of a Muslim is to convert the rest of humanity to Islam, and that the world should be governed by laws that were divinely ordained, and that it is a sin for anyone in the U.S. Congress or the Canadian Parliament or the British House of Commons or the French Senate, for anyone or the Indian Parliament to make laws that govern human behavior or human interaction. The criminal codes are considered sinful. The civil procedures that we all follow, the freedom of press and freedom of speech that are enjoined in our constitutions, are all considered sinful. Their notion is of the their notion of a judiciary is a scholar of Islam who would impart and interpret Sharia, and for the judge to impose sanctions based on Sharia law. That is universal in almost most of the mosque area Muslims.
This is one of the things that this fellow Badawi himself is active in, as I understand it, with the Fiqh Council of North America, is promulgating these fatwas and so on to help effectively adjudicate matters according to Sharia. But this really goes to the very heart of our societies, and indeed in the United States, our Constitution. Tariq Fatah is our guest. He is an extraordinary and very courageous man who has spoken out against what many are doing in the name of Islam in his own country and in ours, notably, but not exclusively, in our film Islam versus Islamists and in his weekly columns with the Toronto Sun. And Tariq, just to bore in on this, the Canadian Parliament has recently held hearings into what is going on, in which they took testimony, as I understand it, from a number of Muslims who were warning very much along the lines of what you are. What was the reaction in the Senate in Canada?
Well, the Senate Parliamentary Committee on National Defense and Security has been tasked by the Parliament to submit a report on how to fight terrorism, on threats to national security, or the radicalization of Muslim youth. And very rarely do we secular Muslims get a chance ever to speak about such issues. But a number of us went there individually. We had an hour with the seven-member committee. And when we explained to them or gave our recommendations of how to fight this, what we noticed is that the deputy chair, Senator Grant Mitchell, who's a liberal, would confront us and say that what we were uttering was complete falsehood. It almost reminded me of the Bachman and five colleagues who wanted to hear from Humar Abedin in the United States. And repeatedly, when any witness comes forward and says that the mosques in North America are incubators within which are born future jihadists, he simply wouldn't accept it and would deny it. When Hassan al-Banna's testimony, you know, the founder of the Muslim Brotherhood, who was assassinated in, I think, 1930s, when his quotes were delivered as to the language that is used in Hamas, the senator had the audacity to say that this man doesn't live in Canada. So why are we worried? They do not understand that this is a transnational, international ideological war, quite similar to what the Comintern or the Communist International had in the 20s and 30s.
Our colleague and frequent guest on this program, Tariq Fatah, as you probably know, Andy McCarthy has coined a phrase for this. He calls it willful blindness. And the trouble is, of course, that when you choose not to see, or in this case, hear what people who have firsthand knowledge of what is being done by these Muslim Brotherhood front organizations in what they call the course of their civilization jihad, you really are putting us all in mortal peril because, as you know so well, it's unlikely to stop with this, I don't think of it so much as nonviolent jihad as pre-violent jihad. It will become more violent if it is rewarded by the sort of submission that you've just described in your country. And let me just, in closing, ask you, we're almost out of time, but very quickly, in your country, I think your government is rather more robust on these matters than ours under Prime Minister Harper. But is it the case there, as it certainly is here, that the government is taking counsel, taking, in fact, direction from these Muslim Brotherhood front organizations like the Islamic Society of North America, for example?
I don't think the political government is taking that, but certainly the security agencies, the Royal Mounted Canadian Police, the RCMP, or our intelligence services, I would dare to suggest that they have some sort of an infiltration that has been very well worked out, where they do not speak to any Muslim who doesn't wear a beard or doesn't wear put a whole lot of cloth over himself or is not dressed like the clown that they would like Muslims to be.
Tariq Fatah, thank you for the work you do with the Toronto Sun and, as I say, for your courageousness in helping the rest of us who choose not to be willfully blind to see what's happening in our countries. Keep up the good work, my friend. We'll talk with you again very soon. Next up, we will be speaking with Bill Gertz. He will take us for a tour inside the ring. Straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
I lost my healthy 27-year-old son to influenza. Jacob wasn't someone you'd expect to die from the flu. He was strong, a martial arts athlete. After 5 weeks of fighting, Jacob died.
I'm Dr. Bill Schaffner of the National Foundation for Infectious Diseases. Each year, influenza claims the lives of Americans of all ages, including healthy young adults like Jacob. Ask about vaccination the next time you're at your doctor's office or pharmacy. Visit adultvaccination.org.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. I'm very pleased to say we're joined by a man I've known for a long time and have been privileged to work with over much of that period. He is Senator Mark Kirk. He represents the people of Illinois in the United States Senate. Previously represented some of them in the House of Representatives for 5 terms. Before all that, he was on the staff of the United States House of Representatives and a uniformed officer in the United States Navy Reserve, where he had a specialty in intelligence, which is pretty handy in the line of work he's in at the moment, because one of the things that Senator Kirk has distinguished himself in particular in recent years has been a watchman on the wall with respect to the Iranian nuclear threat and a very harsh and very well-informed critic of what the Obama administration is doing and all of that. We're delighted to have a chance to talk with him. Mark Kirk, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio, sir. Good to have you with us.
Frank, thank you for having me.
Well, could we get your, intelligence assessment, Senator, as to where we are now with the talks that the president has extended and the deal that he seems desperate to conclude with the Iranian regime?
The problem that we have is Secretary Kerry has already testified before the Senate that he estimated the Iranians need only a, quote, couple of months to finish their atomic bomb program. Now the in the sanctions talks, he has given the Iranians 219 extra days to complete their atomic bomb program. I'm very concerned that this is an enabling environment to see a world in which Iranian nukes are present. My top goal is to make sure the next generation of Americans never has to witness a nuclear war in the Persian Gulf. We really need to work hard to make sure we protect American children from witnessing that future.
Senator, one of the concerns that I have, of course, is that it may not just be a nuclear war in the Persian Gulf or even afflicting our friends in Israel, but that the Iranians have set their sights on us as well. One of your former colleagues in the House of Representatives, as you may know, Trent Franks, recently discussed publicly a translated military doctrine of the Iranians, which makes reference 20 times to the use of electromagnetic pulse as part of their attack doctrine. Should we be concerned about American children here at home, as well as our interests and allies overseas?
Frank, I'll talk to you as an old Navy intel officer. I'm not that concerned about EMP. EMP requires a working weapon, which nearly everyone and the Israelis think the Iranians don't have yet. The reason why the Iranians are working so hard is they don't have a working weapon.
Well, I hope you're right, and I hope that that will remain the case. The problem with this, as you know, as an old intelligence officer, of course, is that you don't have to have a sophisticated working weapon. And my guess is between the North Koreans and perhaps the Pakistanis, who knows who all else, they may well have acquired one that does.
Frank, I think you're exactly correct. I think the actual design of the weapon in Iran will look a lot like whatever the North Koreans have built, and will look like a lot what the Paks have.
And here's the kicker, Senator. One of the things that we've been told is that when the EMP Threat Commission that the House of Representatives commissioned some time ago, as you know, looked into this, the Russians told them that they gave the North Koreans a super EMP weapon. So if you're right, and I think you are, that may be what we're looking at in the near future. But, Senator, let me ask you about another problem, and that is, quite apart from the use of a nuclear weapon against us, we had a report last week by a group called Psylance of what they called Operation Cleaver, which indicates that Iranian cyber hackers have gotten inside of our electric grid control systems maybe for as long as 2 years. This really bespeaks, together with that doctrine and so on, a very direct animus towards this country on the part of the regime. Does this seem to be a complete disconnect from the way the administration is treating these guys?
You know, I would say the cyber threat to the country is probably not well understood or perceived. It's probably even bigger than we realize.
To the extent that that's so, again, are you sensing, and I'd be interested in what your colleagues and some of them on the other side of the aisle as well have expressed the sorts of concerns you have and have been expressing an interest in getting sanctions reestablished on the Iranian regime. I'm told they're getting something on the order of $700 million a month now, $23 million a day, because of the relief from sanctions that the administration has given them. But are you sensing that your colleagues are at a point where they're saying, you know, enough of this? This is not working out?
Yeah, Frank, I'm working night and day to reestablish sanctions on Iran to make sure that we can get the 67 votes that would mightily impress the President of the United States that we're serious about this. Once we get to 67 votes in the Senate, it doesn't really matter what Obama thinks about this, to reimpose sanctions on Iran to make sure that we protect our kids from that horrible future of a nuclear war in the Persian Gulf.
Is this something that you think is in prospect, Senator, on the basis of particularly the new order of things in the United States Senate come January?
I've been working very carefully with our new Majority Leader, Mitch McConnell. The problem that we've had with sanctions is that Harry Reid, who was the Majority Leader, had promised the President to use his scheduling powers of the Senate to never have a vote on Iranian sanctions. The great thing about the decision the American people have made with the recent election is putting Mitch McConnell in the Majority Leader seat. He will actually schedule a Iranian sanctions vote, unlike Reid. So I would expect early in the Republican majority that Mitch will come out, will schedule a vote. We'll be working with a lot of folks on the outside who are concerned to make sure we get up to 67 members.
I will hope you will count on us to help in that regard, Senator, because I can think of few things that are more
important. I would hope that anybody listening here contacts your senator and tell them to vote in favor of the Menendez-Kirk Iranian sanctions package that's going to be coming forward.
Senator Bob Menendez, of course, being the outgoing chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, one of the more thoughtful members of the Democratic caucus at the moment on these sorts of matters, and I'm so pleased he's helping you with this. Senator, let me just ask you, as an old intelligence guy, about one piece of this equation that has really vexed me. And again, it's against the backdrop of what we're hearing from the International Atomic Energy Agency, let alone, you know, various intelligence agencies. This is the UN body that is supposed to be monitoring this interim deal, and they're saying they're being frozen out. Senator, that's a problem in its own right. But what about, are you concerned that there is almost certainly a covert or clandestine aspect to this Iranian nuclear program that we still aren't aware of, let alone adequately monitoring?
I would offer a poor requotation of Rumsfeld. There are known knowns and unknown unknowns. We don't know everything about the Iranian program. We have to think that they probably, since the Iranians have spent billions hiding it, they have probably succeeded from hiding some of it from us.
Senator, lastly, the Saudis have, as you know, taken steps, they said, to basically undermine our energy sector by continuing to produce sufficient amounts of oil to have prices falling as they are now worldwide. This is a particular problem, besides for our energy sector, those independents mostly, but for the Iranians and the Russians and the Venezuelans and so on. But specifically, Senator, in this context, what do you think are the implications of that for the Iranian program and maybe for the regime itself?
I would say that we understand the Iranians peg their economy and their government to assume a $140 per barrel price of oil. Now I think we are down to, as I saw from the latest news, like 59. That puts a great pressure on the Iranian government. They may actually have to miss a payment to the terrorist group Hezbollah.
Senator, we have to let you go. Thank you very much for joining us. We look forward to talking with you again soon. Next up, Bill Gertz joins us. We'll get his take on the possibility that over 100 million of us may die as a result of the grid going down and staying down. That and more straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
People from around the country have no clue what we're like here in Washington, D.C. Yeah, we've got our whack jobs like the guy who climbed the fence and walked around the White House. We have the people who see the black helicopters. But there's one common denominator for all of us, friends and family. And there's no place where a relationship means more than it does right here. Yeah, we may be famous for the dignitaries, but friends and family, that makes us tick. And frankly, this radio station gets that. That's why I listen. AM 1260. The answer.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We're joined, as we have the very high privilege of being each week, by one of the preeminent national security reporters of our time. He is Bill Gertz, the senior editor for the Washington Free Beacon, and also a prize-winning columnist for the Washington Times. He calls his Inside the Ring column just that, and takes us on a tour of it each week. Bill Gertz, welcome back. It's good to have you with us.
Hi, Frank. Good to be on the program.
Well, there's so much that you've been covering, Bill, but I want to start with something that broke just today at your site on the Washington Free Beacon's pages. Talk about the latest revelations of the extreme peril we face as a result of the vulnerability of our electric grid.
Yeah, this is an important story. Under the Freedom of Information Act, the Department of Homeland Security and Federal Emergency Management Agency released details of a 2012 study that looks at the impact of a major solar storm, geomagnetic storm is what they're calling it, and the results are fairly dire. It says basically that 100 million people would lose electricity with potentially catastrophic loss of life associated with that. Now, these are very rare events, but they have happened in the past. 1859 was one, 1921 was another, but those were periods when the use of electricity was minimal. And now we're so dependent on electricity that this DHS study looked at the cascading failures to our water, to our communications, to our transportation, all the things that would be affected by a major blackout of electricity. And there's debate about how severe it would be and whether or not we could recover quickly from such a weather storm, as they're calling it.
Yeah, and as I read it, your reporting indicates that they think we may lose as many as 300 of the high voltage and extremely high voltage transformers that really are the backbone of the grid, and for which there is essentially no replacement, certainly not in any timely fashion, which means that those millions and millions and millions of Americans, however large the number actually is, would be without power for a very protracted time, and presumably many of them would perish, Bill. Isn't that right?
Absolutely. I mean, the money quote from the study says that the impact would, the greatest challenge will be to provide life-saving and life-sustaining resources for large numbers of people who experience a long-term outage from damage to the electrical grid. And this was what the FEMA document states.
That sort of sounds like a bureaucratic understatement of epic proportions to me,
yeah,
Bill.
The FEMA report is trying to downplay a more dire study that came out a couple years before that, which really talked about these 300 transformers going down. And their assessment was that the damage to these transformers will not be repairable. In other words, they'll have to be replaced. And that's, you know, if they're correct, and again, the interesting thing about the FEMA study is it says, well, we really don't know what the damage will be. So, and they called for more study, and this was 2 years ago. So it makes you wonder whether they're really up to speed on this problem or not. And of course, there are implications for defense there with the EMP threat.
You bet. Well, for the defense of the country in the sense that there won't be a country if this kind of threat, whether it's the naturally occurring kind, and you're right, they don't happen all that often, but they do happen very cyclically, like every 150 years by some estimates. So there's another one in our future. Just a final point on this, there is a superb video that I commend to all of our listeners by Bill Whittle, who is a very clever quite sardonic commentator at PJ Media. Check it out at pjtv.com. He calls it Lights Out. And if you really want to understand what Bill's just talked about, this brings it home quite vividly. Bill, let me turn to another subject you've been covering intensively for a long time. And again, this is one of the things that we admire and value so much about your reporting. Nobody covers the ins and outs of the arms control issues as you do. Talk about the hearing that took place on Capitol Hill this week, looking into the violations of the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty, and talk that you've been picking up that some, at least in the Pentagon, think it may be time for us to return long-range intermediate, LRINF is what we used to call them, long-range intermediate-range nuclear forces into Europe in the form, I guess, of cruise missiles.
Yeah, this is an extremely important but vastly underreported story, and there was a hearing on Capitol Hill this week which discussed Russian cheating on the 1987 Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty. This violation in the form of a brand new cruise missile that the Russians are close to deploying, they haven't identified it by name, but military analysts say it's the R-500. And this missile has prompted the U.S. to try and deal with it. Now, the problem with the Obama administration is they covered up this violation for years as part of their arms control-centered agenda. And there were a lot of angry members of Congress, of the House Armed Services and House Foreign Affairs Committee, who challenged Rose Gottmuller, the Undersecretary of State for Arms Control, on what the United States was going to do about it. And she basically stonewalled the entire panel by saying, we're going to stay in this treaty because we think it's in the U.S. security interest. Nobody asked her why it's in the U.S. security interest if the Russians are violating it in an extremely militarily significant way. But there was some heated exchange, and along with Rose Gottmuller was a Pentagon policymaker named Brian McKeon, who was pressed on what were the military responses. If it reaches the point where the U.S. were to pull out of the treaty, and many of the members were advocating that, one option being studied is to return our ground-launched cruise missiles, nuclear-armed ground-launched cruise missiles, to Europe, which would certainly be a monumental step forward in countering this new threat from Russia.
Well, it would be a monumental step, period, if it were possible to do. I, as you may remember, Bill, back when we first met, I think I was in the Pentagon trying to get those cruise missiles in the first place, along with Pershing 2 missiles, before there was an intermediate-range nuclear forces treaty. I warned when that treaty was completed that it was unverifiable and would be problematic in the extreme if the Russians wound up doing what they have done. In the interval, we have taken all of those weapons out, and I can't conceive of any of those governments being willing to put them back in, despite what you're correct in saying is a very real threat from the Russians. And unfortunately, Bill, as you know so well, it's being accompanied by actual threats to use such weapons against our allies. Bill, let me turn to another topic. Nobody, again, covers China as well as you either, especially its military activities. What is the nature of this hypersonic weapon system that they've been developing and apparently have now put through their third test?
Yeah, the Chinese Defense Ministry this week confirmed my exclusive report in the Free Beacon of December 4th, which revealed that China, for this year, conducted the third test of an ultra-high-speed maneuvering strike vehicle, which the military believes is part of China's growing strategic nuclear buildup. This is unprecedented in the history of Chinese weapons development. They have taken years to develop missiles in the past. Here you have a unique high-tech missile, which is maneuvering and can defeat U.S. missile defenses, and they've conducted a third test. I would almost venture to say that the intelligence community is close to declaring this as part of some initial operating capability because, unlike the U.S. Weapons testing regime, the Chinese can test several times and then basically have a weapon that they could use in a crisis or a future conflict.
Certainly seeing that with their space weapon systems, as you know and have covered so well, Bill. We have to leave it at that, I'm afraid, for the moment. Bill, thank you so much for this extraordinarily rich and very worrying series of intelligence reports, briefings on your part, as well as what you've done over the past week in the Washington Free Beacon and at the Washington Times. Keep up the great work, my friend. Come back to us again next week. I hope the rest of you will do the same. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.